Talk given Saturday, 17th January 1981. Karma is misrepresented as retributive justice. I believe probably the translation of karma as retributive justice by European scholars came into being because of their study of Greek. You know, in Greek mythology, we have the goddess Nemesis, who is the goddess of retributive justice. Now, this is a hopeless mistranslation. The phrase itself is a self-contradictory phrase. It has no meaning whatsoever, as we shall see in a few moments. Karma has also been presented as equilibration. One does, one feels things, does so and so, and therefore a corresponding, exact and equal opposite result comes about. This is partly due to Newton's third law of motion. Action and reaction are equal and opposite. That holds good only in the realm of mechanics, and in that part of mathematics which deals with the macroscopic scale, not the microscopic. In the subatomic realm, all that is nonsensical. And it has been presented, especially by those who think that they have understood Buddhist teaching, as a rigid law of causation. So many of the translations of the discourses of the Buddha, especially the two of the long discourses in the Digha Nikaya, which deal with this question of causation, it has been presented in a very rigid way, which does not hold good, which cannot hold good, as I trust we shall be able to see in the course of the evening. Now, there is a grain of truth in the above misconceptions. Because even a gross misconception does have a grain of truth hidden somewhere. A grain of wheat in the midst of a ton of chaff. What is this truth? The truth is that there is a relationship, bear this carefully in mind, there is a relationship between an action now and of an appearance or phenomenon later on in time. There is a relationship between them. But to say that the action now is the sole cause of the phenomenon later on is quite untrue. The Buddha put it, actually the Buddha put it in a very sensible and sensible form. He said, that being, this becomes. You see, we think of any one thing as persisting as such in time. If we say that let A represent something, well, we take it for granted that A will always be A. That piano, A, will always be that piano. But it won't. It doesn't. There is continuous change. And in certain instances, as for instance in a solid object, that change is so slow that it is not possible for our consciousness to register that change, or even for our senses to observe that change. That is why we are inclined to believe in our ordinary life that A will always reliably remain A. No, A at this moment is A plus or minus X as a few moments later. And X becomes larger and larger as time goes on. So that A never remains A. It's always changing. The whole universe is a universe which is ceaselessly changing. Now let us take a commoner garden example. of what actually happens. A man and his wife conjugate on the 1st of January, and on the 7th of October, 280 days later, a baby arrives. Now some people will ask, well, whose karma was it, the man's or the wife's or the baby's karma? Some will say so-and-so's karma. Others will say, oh, it is the karma of all three. All those statements are only very, very partially true, for the very simple reason that between the 1st of January and the 7th of October, 1,000, 10,000, maybe 20,000 different influences, factors, people, events, circumstances, all of which are changing, have interplayed with that fetus. There. So you say, you can't have a rigid view that this happened on the 1st of January, therefore on the 7th of October that happened, and that is all there is about it. There isn't. There is an enormous amount involved in it. Karma is not a simple 1 + 1 = 2 affair. And even modern mathematics knows that the simple statement A + B = B + A is not true under all circumstances. Karma is an involved process of unimaginable complexity. We have to observe and understand karma as process. Don't think of it as cause and effect, action and result. That is too narrow a view. See it as process, and see it as universal process, not as particular process. Of course, we being what we are, having only two eyes in our head and so forth, we can see only a tiny bit of the universe. So naturally we will see particulars. But bear in mind always that the particular is in constant interaction with the totality. This is a scientific fact now. The scientists of our own age, especially within the last 20 years, know beyond a shadow of a doubt that any one process which is observable is actually completely is in complete interaction with every other process in the universe. The universe functions, it lives as a whole, as a single entity. It doesn't function as a collection of separate bits. We observe the universe as separate bits because we, constituted as we are, and conscious in the manner and to the degree in which we are conscious, we cannot avoid regarding the universe as composed of multitudinous bits. Within limits, it is true to say that it is so, the limits being imposed by the fact that we are constituted like this, and we are conscious only in this manner as yet. We are not cosmically conscious. We are not universally conscious. That is why. So, always bear in mind that when observing any sequence of events, as we call them, that sequence of events is completely tied up with the entire universal process. And that is karma. Now let us consider. It is not very intelligent to say, oh, this is my karma, or that is your karma. It's no good talking in those terms. Instead of saying my karma or your karma, it is karma, the universal process, which has me or you. Not that I or you have karma. Karma has you or me. Now, you see how the mind can become free of tremendous amount of unnecessary and foolish limitation imposed upon it. And if the mind becomes free of that, that means your observation of your living process will be purer, will be truer to the reality, and will be something which promotes growth. That is, will promote progressive change, not fortuitous or regressive change. Now, take this phrase, retributive justice. I've already said, I think, that it is a self-contradictory phrase. You can't use the word justice and then qualify it by the word retributive. Retribution or punishment is of the nature of vengeance, or sometimes it is of the nature of cruelty, pain deliberately inflicted for some action or crime or whatever it is that has been committed by somebody. That is retribution. It is rooted in hate, fear, violence, and unskill in action are associated with it. Particularly note, especially if you are interested in yoga and practice yoga, unskill in action. You remember what Sri Krishna said to Arjuna? Arjuna, yoga is skill in action. And remember that the word karma literally means, in the transcendentally, creative action in eternity. And generally speaking, the word karma means action. Action in thought, in speech, and in deed. So, retribution maintains conflict. Because since it's an act of vengeance, then the person upon whom that act has been perpetrated will bear it in mind and want to get his own back and strike back again. The whole history of the human race has been full of that, both on the small personal and individual scale as well as on the national and international scale. Vengeance and so forth, violence, fear, hate, and unskill in action, they do not conduce to progressive change, to growth which culminates in one's true flowering and fulfillment, and therefore true happiness. The happiness which you never have had to grasp or to chase after, but which is there naturally and sweetly, simply because you are living in tune with the law that governs the entire universal process. Retribution belongs to and confines us to the context of the finite, to sorrow, to decay, to death, to bondage, and to evil. Retribution does all those things. To put it in another form, retribution does not heal. It does not make whole, healthy. It does not release perfect holiness or uphold the holy state. You see? Which should be the normal human state, because the very word human has that implication. Divinity is embodied in us. So that is what is trying to emerge out of the human kingdom in the course of evolution. Retribution is obviously not creative action. Karma is creative activity. Now, justice heals. If it is real justice, it heals. For it holds within itself mercy and compassion, patience and forbearance, deep understanding and wisdom. So wherever there is the expression of true justice, there is a healing, a whole making. It is justice is rooted, unlike retribution, which is rooted in the finite, justice is rooted in the infinite and immortal, because in arriving at its judgments, it is sensitive to many of the elements which compose the karmic process, and it has a vision of the relationship of these elements to the creative activity of karma. Now, the creative activity of karma has as its context the transcendental context, the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. And this is a power which persuasively moves all things towards their true fulfillment. Note carefully, persuasively moves, never compels. I've said 100 times, if I've said it once at our meetings, transcendence never compels. It abides with infinite patience, because its abiding is not in terms of time, but in terms of eternity, which subsumes all time as well as the timeless states. So do bear that in mind. I hope this is not a little bit too difficult for some of you, but you'll get it. Thus we see that retributive justice is a self-contradictory phrase. The context of retribution is the finite and the mortal and the painful and the horrible, and the context of justice is the very reverse of all that. Not the mere opposite, mind you, but that which completely transcends the context of retribution. Now the great teachers, the perfected holy ones, knew this all too well. Let us just note what they have taught. In St. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, Sermon on the Mount, it starts at the one section I want to read to you starts from verse 38. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil. It's a very profound teaching, and I wonder how many of the thousands of millions who have peopled Christendom through the 20 centuries have ever even begun to understand the significance of that statement. Resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. Ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Pray for them. And the art of praying for them was taught by the Buddha wonderfully 5 centuries earlier. We'll come to that in a moment. Jesus says all this, that in order that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. In the Kabbalistic terms, Abba, the son of the unknown, Abba. Abba in Chokhmah, wisdom. That is the Father in heaven, in Kabbalistic language. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans the same? And so forth. You see, goes on. Now, we see here a presentation of justice in the transcendental sense, not in the sense in which mankind thinks of justice as a tit-for-tat situation. You see, that's very, very important. Now, the Buddha, speaking to the bhikkhus in this discourse, which is the Kakachupama Sutta, the parable of the saw, the double-handled saw, he says to them, to the bhikkhus, there are, monks, five ways of speaking in which others, when speaking to you, might speak. At a right time or a wrong time, according to fact or not according to fact, gently or harshly, on what is connected with the goal or on what is not connected with the goal, with a mind of friendliness or full of hatred. Those are the five ways in which people might speak to the monks. And the Buddha goes on a little later. Herein, monks, that is, when they hear such speech, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell, with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred. And we will dwell, having suffused that person with a mind of friendliness, and beginning with him, we will dwell, having suffused the whole world with a mind like the earth, far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. This is how you must train yourselves, monks. You will note here that the answer of the holy ones to any problem which emerges out of the context of the finite, the temporal and the mortal, the realm of ill, the realm of dukkha, the only answer to that is always a transcendent answer. There is nothing else which will heal the ill state of our condition. It is right from the innermost depths that the answer has to come. And that is the only answer. I've said this before too. You notice that none of the great teachers, the truly great spiritual teachers, ever produced a political philosophy or an economic system or a sociological idea or anything like that. They were concerned with the truth, with the reality with which they themselves were entirely in harmony, entirely in tune. They were the children of their Father in heaven, and they gave, therefore, the blessing of that which can come only from that divine source, their teaching on these matters. A little later, he ends up thus. Monks, even if low-down thieves might carve you limb from limb with a double-handled saw, yet even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity, he, for this reason, is not a doer of my teaching. Herein, monks, you should train yourselves thus. neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell, with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred. And beginning with him, we will dwell, having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. That is how you must train yourselves, monks. You see how the teaching takes us right out of the limited, painful plane of the limited and the particular, the restricted, and takes us right out of that into the illimitable, the transcendent, the everlastingly happy, the everlastingly holy, whole, complete, true. Now, this is the sort of teaching which applies to the realm of justice. So, to talk of justice as retributive justice is absolutely absurd, isn't it? Here, the emphasis is supremely on the absolute virtue as such. And I think you will all be interested to know, unless you know it already, that Aristotle taught that justice is the practice of virtue towards others. Virtue not in the limited dualistic sense which is the way in which we define virtue as the opposite of vice, but virtue in the absolute sense. You will find this subject treated by Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics, Book 5, Chapter 3, Chapter 2. Now, Plato gives a slightly different idea, but essentially the same, in his Republic. There he presents justice as the effective harmony of the whole. Not in terms of particulars, but in terms of the whole. And the actual words which are used are, justice is the having and doing what is one's own. It's in the Republic, section 433. Having and doing what is one's own. Now that sounds quite a flat, a sort of a disappointing conception of justice. But think, he develops it this way. Each man shall receive the equivalent of what he produces or gives, and shall perform the functions for which he is best fit. A just man, therefore, is a man in his right place, doing his best, giving to society the full equivalent of what society gives him. There's only one thing there which I would like to see different. I would leave out the word equivalent, because the word equivalent involves measurement. You can measure that which belongs to the context of the finite and the perishable, the mortal. But you cannot measure the infinite and the immortal. There is no measurement there. When you give fully and completely, then there is no measurement possible. No comparison is possible in the realm of transcendence. So I would put it this way, a just man is a man in his right place, doing his best, without any measurement of what is the best or thing, giving the best of himself, giving to society in full the whole of himself, of what in response to what society gives him. Now, if we had a society in which all people lived like that, we would have a somewhat different state of affairs. A somewhat easier condition, at least, in which all of us could live. Isn't that so? And consider Plato and Aristotle flourished in the 4th century BC. And they said these things. And the Buddha, a century earlier, he was a century before Socrates actually, rather more than a century before Plato and Aristotle, he taught in the same transcendental terms. So now, I hope we are beginning to get a slightly less restricted view of the meaning of the word karma. Now let us take that other absurdity. Newton's action and reaction are equal and opposite. Now that is applicable in the realm of mechanics and mathematics, and it is true in that context. But it is manifestly absurd where the understanding of karma is concerned. Especially in the Buddhist context. The Hindu context doesn't put it so clearly as the Buddhist context does. The Buddha clearly taught that nothing remains changeless. So, where any action is concerned, how are you to measure that action? Because that action is continuously undergoing change the very next instant. And that change proceeds on and on so that it eludes any possibility of accurate measurement. And how, even if you could measure within our limits what an action is like, how are we going to return precisely that same amount, equal and opposite? Now even suppose that that were possible, that it could be done, what would the situation be? It would be like a stagnant pond. No growth, nothing further. It would be just static. It would be a static equilibrium. And there is nothing in the universe which is a static equilibrium. The actual living process of the whole universe is one of continuous change, a continuous dynamism, but a dynamism which, because it functions according to karmic law, is a dynamic poise. It's not a static equilibrium. This is very important. It's not easy to grasp, I grant you, intellectually. Because we naturally, when we talk about a balance, we think in terms of two scale pans, you know, and when they stop wiggling about, we say, ah, now that's that's balanced. But that is not the true meaning of balance. The true inner meaning of balance in the living sense is to be in that state of inward mastery of oneself, which prevents any complete overthrow of one's calm. One remains calm in the midst of the storm. That sort of idea. That is the real balance, the real equilibrium for human beings. Now, then again consider, if the result of action should be equal and opposite to the action, it must be opposite in every sense of the word opposite. All right, if I perform a good act, I should receive something evil in return. Obviously. You see the absurdity of thinking of karma in those terms. I trust that these trite examples will show us the necessity for clearing out of our brains all the accumulated dust and dirt, the misconceptions and the misinterpretations which bedevil the whole process of our lives from day to day. Because all these misconceptions condition us and influence our life continuously. So if we have faulty influences at work, our life will also suffer from faultiness, obviously. That is why it is so important to to clear all the cobwebs out of our brains. You know how the Buddha always said, do not believe anything, do not hold a fixed idea because I have said it or a teacher has said it, because it is the commonly accepted thing. Examine it, find out for yourself. And if you find that it is really true and good for you, very well, then carry on with it. But if you find that it is not so, reject it. And keep investigating constantly. Constant investigation is one of the seven limbs of enlightenment, as the Buddhist texts put it. One of the limbs of enlightenment. Constant investigation. The Buddha himself never ceased investigating. Don't think that when he's supposed to have reached enlightenment at the age of 35, that didn't mean that he got his his final PhD from the Almighty or whoever it was, that now you are enlightened, go and teach, and so forth. Nothing of the sort. He was constantly investigating, constantly observing. In our own day and age, we have an example in Krishnamurti. Constantly investigating. Constantly finding out, trying to find out, what is the fact? Keep an open mind and grow that way. Now, therefore, we should see that rigid causation must be ruled out. Karma is not rigid causation. So we may see that in the universal flux of the ceaseless becoming process, what appears as a cause or a set of causes at any one instant change into effects the next instant, which in turn are causes for the next change, and so forth. It is a growing process, it's a living process. This makes karma, brings karma to life. It's not a miserable dead law which just works like a useless automaton all the way through, tit for tat. It's a living universe expressing laws which in themselves are alive all the time, functioning livingly. And because of that, we, if we understand them, can so live that we'll see that each of us or any one thing is never the sole exclusive agent of any action. The people who haven't any common sense will say, oh, you did so and so in a past life and therefore you are experiencing the reward or the misery for that action in this life. It is the sheerest nonsense spoken by which has emanated out of idiotic brains. You just can't trace it. The whole process, the universal process, is a one process altogether in which countless innumerable parts interplay all the time. And how are you going to apportion out karma like that? It's totally impossible. The theosophists, for instance, talked about the lords of karma who keep accounts. My word, I should like to see their account books. Look, if you read the Heart of Religion carefully, you will find a suggestion there which is somewhat more sensible than the lords of karma keeping accounts idea. Any thought that or feeling that you have, any word that you speak, any action that you perform, has an immediate electrochemical activity going on in the brain, the nervous system, and the whole body. So you see, they produce their results, obviously. Electrochemical forces are not just ornaments sitting upon a mantelpiece. They are forces which are actually active. If you go through constant anxiety, you know you'll have trouble in your insides, and which may sometimes necessitate an operation. You know that. So that this karmic process, the particular condition becoming the other thing, goes on instantaneously and continuously without a stop. No one can therefore escape karma. Karma and oneself are one great movement. You are karma manifesting. And it's no good asking all sorts of unanswerable questions. What did this poor fellow, such a nice man, do to deserve this? There is no question of deserving. It is how it happened. And it is for us to understand how it happened. And to see it, and to help him to see it from the transcendental point of view. Because that is the only sensible point of view which works ultimately. So it is impossible to allocate karma to any person or thing. All we can say is that the karmic process is constantly proceeding according to law. That is, whatever is or occurs at any point instant. Point instant, that means here. The point is here, instant, now, in space-time. Whatever happens in space-time is the resultant of all the forces at play. And all the forces at play are the total number of forces operating throughout the whole universe. And nobody can keep any accounts of that. And they all just, and the whole thing operates by itself. Law, karma, is inherent in the very structure of the universe. It's inherent in the very structure of your body and psyche. That is why you can't get away with it, or escape it, or try and cajole it to be otherwise, or divert it in any way. That's all nonsense. You must just see the fact straight in the eye, absolutely see it for what it is, and try and be in tune with your vision. Don't ask somebody else to inform you, because somebody else's information is not going to be really of ultimate help. See it for yourself. You've got a pair of eyes, and if you haven't got a pair of physical eyes, at least you have mental eye, the mental eye. See for yourself and act accordingly. Then you'll be acting also in harmony with the universal law of karma. So now, if we can perceive the true nature, more or less, of karma, we can direct the course of our life intelligently and humanly. We can cease to be producers of evil and swim contrary to the stream of suffering engulfing all that lives.